Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting of Wednesday, January 14th of the Transportation Policy and Finance Meeting to order. And Representative Petersburg, would you move the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes as presented.
Thank you. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Those minutes are approved. Well, welcome back, everyone. We're going to continue our overview from our fine staff of Mr. Burris and Mr. Lee. And that's going to be the first part of our meeting today, and then we're going to move on to discussion with the Port Authority. So, Mr. Burris or Mr. Lee, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff, and I'm joined by Matt Burris from House Research. Today we'll be going over an overview of transit finance and then covering some other budgetary accounts that the committee has oversight over and doing a recap and some recent history of transportation changes. But before I start with transit, I'd like to go back and correct something I had said earlier with regard to the motor vehicle lease sales tax. I was corrected by someone in MnDOT after the hearing on Monday, so it's on page 7 of the PowerPoint, slide 13. And I had said that $32 million of the motor vehicle lease sales tax revenue goes into the general fund, and that's correct, and that about $22 to $23 million goes into Greater Minnesota Transit in fiscal 14, and that was also correct. But what I said in error was that the same amount that went to Greater Minnesota Transit also went to the five metropolitan counties. For fiscal 14, that wasn't correct. For fiscal 14, only $9 million went to five metropolitan counties, and that's because in the 2013 session there was a change that capped the amount going to the metropolitan counties at just $9 million for the 14-15 biennium. All the growth would go to Greater Minnesota Transit. However, that cap was removed, and the 50-50 split between the counties and Greater Minnesota Transit went back into effect for the fiscal year 2015 and continues out. So the total of the tax, so general fund, Greater Minnesota Transit, and the five metropolitan counties was $64 million in fiscal 14, $70 million in fiscal, is projected to be $70 million in fiscal 15, and about $74 million in fiscal 16. So.
And clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I will move back over to transit finance. So that is on page 18, starting on slide 36. So unlike highway finance, which is largely dictated by formulas and the state having a very large role in the operation of the trunk highway system, The transit service is completely provided by political subdivisions of the state, so local governments and the Metropolitan Council. The Metropolitan Council, as I said, provides transit service in the metropolitan area through Metro Transit and other contracted services. In addition to Metro Transit, there are a number of suburban transit providers, sometimes known as opt-outs, that provide transit services in several cities in the south and west of the Twin Cities Metro. In addition to those, there are a few independent transit providers. The largest in terms of ridership is the University of Minnesota, which provides a bus service in between the two campuses. There are a variety of transit systems in Greater Minnesota. Some are owned and operated by cities or counties, and some are joint powers agreements between multiple local governments. MnDOT and the Metropolitan Council have powers for setting transit policy and planning, applying for federal funds and administering those funds, and they provide technical and management assistance to transit operators. So the Metropolitan Council, obviously, for Metro Transit, which is an operating arm of the council, in addition to suburban transit providers. And MnDOT provides operational and provides technical assistance to Greater Minnesota Transit Systems. So I've split this out between Greater Minnesota Transit funding sources, and the next few slides will be Metropolitan Area Transit funding sources. So In Greater Minnesota, funding sources include federal aid. The state sources include general fund, which is the base is set at about $16 million a year. And that goes out through an appropriation to MnDOT, and MnDOT then administers the funds out to the various transit operators. The motor vehicle lease sales tax, as I mentioned earlier, which is about $22.6 million in fiscal 14. 4% of the total motor vehicle sales tax revenue, or about $25.6 million in fiscal 14, and general obligation bonds. However, I should note that general obligation bonds can only be used for providing long-term capital in nature projects for Greater Minnesota Transit Systems. They cannot be used to buy buses or provide service. In addition to state and federal sources, local effort, property and sales taxes also support Greater Minnesota Transit Systems and fare box recovery. And moving on to Twin Cities Metropolitan Area Transit, I've split this out between operating and capital. And on this first slide is some operating sources. Like Greater Minnesota Transit, there are some federal grants for operating, but the lion's share of operating subsidy for the Metropolitan Council and other transit operators in the metropolitan area comes from a general fund appropriation with the base set at about $77 million in fiscal 16, and there have been some fluctuations in that in the last biennium, and I'll get into that later, and 36% of invest allocation from the motor vehicle sales tax, and that equates to roughly $230 million in fiscal 14. Like Greater Minnesota Transit, fare box recovery also covers a share of the operating cost, and a small amount comes from regional property levies, although this is not typically direct operating cost. This is a levy that the Metropolitan Council is authorized to levy on property in cities in the metropolitan area that levy transit service, or that provide transit service. And it comes to about $43.2 million a year. And the vast bulk of it is used to pay debt service on bonds issued by the Metropolitan Council for bus replacement, facility repair, but typically not large transitway projects, but kind of the maintenance, the day-to-day stuff to maintain the transit system.
Just one quick question. Do you have approximate numbers for the fare box recovery for 13 or 14?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. In the Metropolitan Council, in its annual budget for calendar year 2015, estimates that about $108 million will be received already? For fare box recovery. That is across bus, light rail, commuter rail, and other transit modes. So that's the solid number. In terms of the ratio of fare box recovery, that varies across mode between bus, Metro Mobility, light rail, and I think that the Metropolitan Council would maybe be a little bit better at providing those numbers when they come to testify. But that's just the Metropolitan Council estimate for fiscal 15.
Thank you.
So then, Mr. Chair and members, moving on to capital sources, the Twin Cities Metropolitan Area has the seven counties of the Metropolitan Area are authorized to issue a local option sales tax. That is 0.25%. In addition to that tax, there's also, and I should probably note this on here, a $20 excise tax on vehicle sales in those counties that are kind of that's attached to that 0.25% sales tax. The receipts of that tax is administered by the County's Transit Improvement Board, which is a joint powers agreement between the five metropolitan counties that currently levy the tax, and they include Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, Anoka, and Washington. In addition to CTIB, federal aid also is used for transit capital projects, and county regional railroad authorities have the ability to levy tax to support those as well. In addition to all that, the State General Fund and general obligation bonds have been used for transitway capital projects.
Okay. And just with following up on the numbers, the quarter percent raises approximately how much?
Approximately, I didn't hear my notes. Believe in calendar year 2013, it raised about $108 million that was transferred to CTIB.
Thank you.
And I should say that a piece of that is required by statute about to cover half the operating cost for transitways. That's the on the line for transitway capital and half of operating costs. And the other half is required to be picked up by the state. And so with that, this is a summary of transit funding. And you'll notice that I picked 2016 as the base because in the past two fiscal years, there have been a few one-time appropriations that were mostly general fund appropriations. One in 2014 that was a general fund appropriation to the Metropolitan Council for $37 million to support construction and, well, planning and engineering for the Southwest Light Rail Line. And $6.5 million in fiscal 15 to Greater Minnesota Transit, just kind of as a one-time bump. But this shows, you'll see on the 40% invest, that's the constitutionally dedicated funds for transit, the general fund, and then the lease sales tax. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Burris for aeronautics.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Burris with House Research. I'll start in on aeronautics as one of the other areas of transportation finance and then briefly touch on a couple of other aspects of transportation finance somewhat more generally. So aeronautics has a finance structure that in some ways parallels that of highways. There's a state airports fund, and there are revenues from three primary sources. Actually, a fourth was recently added. That goes into that fund. This isn't a constitutionally established fund, but it does have a kind of similar general policy rationale that the users of the aviation aeronautics system are those who are paying through these taxes into the fund, and then that those dollars are used for maintenance and operations of aeronautics. There are three primary revenue sources, and let's see, two of the three were somewhat significantly modified in 2013 legislation that's just going into effect. I believe the effective date for both of the core changes was July 1 of 2014. The first of these core revenue sources is the aviation fuel tax. So this is similar to the gas tax. It's a fuel tax on aviation fuel. The rate was modified so that it's a 15 cent per gallon rate on jet fuel and a 5 cent per gallon rate on aviation gasoline. There's also a rebate mechanism that kicks in to place so that that rebate mechanism was narrowed in 2013, so it applies essentially, in effect, it just applies to commercial airlines. And it creates a reduced tax rate depending on the number of gallons consumed. Airlines go through the vast majority of the aviation fuel or utilize the majority of the aviation fuel in Minnesota, and so the tax rate for most of the fuel is at a lower amount. And there's a schedule laying that out in statute. The second of the main taxes is a registration tax, similar to the registration tax for motor vehicles. This is one that's annually imposed on aircraft in Minnesota. And the basis of that is under the 2013 changes now, following a schedule that's laid out in law based on the original value of the aircraft. The third of these core revenue sources is called the airline flight property tax. And it is a tax imposed on commercial airlines, effectively. It's on aircrafts and aircraft equipment. So it's flight property. So it's not property tax in the sense of the land that's owned. It's property tax in the kind of older sense of property of the airline. And the rate for that tax is a little bit unusual. It's It's a variable rate that gets modified every year on the basis of the appropriations that are made through the budgetary process. So the total appropriations out of the state airports fund minus the revenues from the fuel tax and the registration tax and other sources that go into the state airports fund result in a rate. So the difference in other revenues and what is appropriated drives what the rate is for the airline flight property tax. And I'll just mention that the other piece, or one other piece of the 2013 changes with the aeronautics and aviation funding was that the sales tax, the general sales tax, as it applies to aircraft purchases, was dedicated to also go into the state airports fund. There are several other transportation.
Excuse me, Mr. Burris. Yeah, Mr. Chair. I believe Representative Hausman has a question on aeronautics.
Is that the fund, Mr. Chair, thank you, that we shifted from to balance the budget, and did we repay that shift?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, yes. In 2003, there was a $15 million transfer out of the state airports fund. And that was money that was just available in the fund balance. The fund balance had been carried in it for a number of years. And going along with that, or actually following after that, there was a legislative requirement that once the once some other budgetary limits or thresholds were met as far as how much money the state had, that a transfer would need to be made back to sort of repay the state airports fund. That occurred in 2008, but also in 2008 there was a subsequent another transfer of $15 million out of the state airports fund, and that was then repaid in 2014. So now, depending on how you count it, the fund has been made whole from these transfers that have occurred a couple of times, and is currently sitting with a substantial fund balance as a result of this most recent transfer.
All right, please continue. Oh, more. Yes, and thank you, Representative. We're reminded to make sure to use the mic and bring that down when you're asking your questions. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is, who has access to that fund then? What airports have access to that that funding capability?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, the funds are administered by MnDOT, and so MnDOT receives the appropriation of you know, as part of the budget, and there are a couple of grant programs. One is for some operations aspects, and the other of the main ones is for airport capital improvement. So it's a grant program that is administered by MnDOT, and there's a national collection of airports. There's a kind of national system that those airports that are in that system are eligible for federal aid that's also administered through MnDOT. Offhand, I'm not sure on the details of whether those airports that aren't part of this national system, NIPIUS, are also eligible under the state dollars for aid. But I can get you some additional information on the details of those programs.
All right. No further questions at this time?
Yep.
Well, except one. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burris, can you tell me, back on that last slide, what the current aviation registration tax is, the percentages?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there's a schedule of a number of blocks based on the original value of the aircraft. So for aircraft that had a list price of under $500,000, the tax is $100. For aircraft with an original list price of $500,000 to $999,000, the tax goes up to $200. It then scales up over the course of the schedule. At a $40 million and over list price, the tax is $75,000. So, and there are a number of steps in between.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only reason I bring that up is that If somebody has an aircraft valued, well, let's say it was $11 million new, and to this day its value is maybe, well, 1.9, they're still paying in that block based on the $11 million value. And just for the committee to know that, that really takes Minnesota out of the competitiveness for our surrounding states regarding this aircraft registration, and it's not even close.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. I would note that was the, you're probably aware, that was this part of the structure that was in place before the 2013 change, and the sum total of the various changes had the effect of kind of raising some revenue and reducing some. It wasn't exactly revenue neutral, but it was somewhat in the ballpark. So there are differing effects for different taxpayers as a result of those changes.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question then about that. If we're consistently running a significant balance in the fund, was the modification in 2013 to cut some of those revenue sources so that we don't run a significant airport, or is there a reason to run a huge, I don't know how large the sum is that we have in there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, the fund balance is back up because of the transfer in of the $15 million. The past couple of years before that didn't reflect a large balance, and so really what's seen in the forecasted large fund balance in the future to some extent reflects that there hasn't been a budget yet for the upcoming biennium that might spend some of those dollars beyond what the base is, because the forecasting is going to reflect what the base appropriations were from the last budget, which was prior to the $15 million being available, it hadn't been transferred back in yet. So it's from looking at the fund balance standpoint, it's not quite clear whether there's a structural issue with that, or if spending, expenditures of these grant, through these grant programs should increase accordingly. And it might be a couple different policy reactions to this.
Thank you. Let's move forward, please.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, there are a couple of other modes. The complexities around these are less. There's not as much of the dedicated revenue sources and formula allocations. So I'll just briefly highlight that there are a couple of different funding sources and some other modes that are part of the transportation finance world. These include freight rail and passenger rail. In the Department of Public Safety, pipeline safety, in a combination of the Department of Public Safety and MnDOT commercial vehicles, ports as well, which are kind of more at the local level, although there is a Department of Public Safety program around port funding. And there are a variety of sources. On Monday, we discussed general obligation bonding for both transit and highways and other modes. So this is one of the funding streams coming from the state. There are a couple of small general fund appropriations that are a part of the base in the transportation budget. Passenger rail, freight rail has a little, freight rail has a little bit, commercial motor vehicles has a little bit. And there are some federal programs in this area too. And then, Mr. Chair, members, I'll move briefly to a discussion of the budgetary jurisdiction. And this has been kind of touched on in some ways in past points of discussion around transportation finance. But from the standpoint of the budget that will be put together during this legislative session for the upcoming biennium, for transportation, the accounts consist essentially of appropriation spending authority for three agencies. The first of those is the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and that's the funding mainly out of the Trunk Highway Fund for trunk highway maintenance, agency operations. The department does receive a couple of general fund appropriations. I just mentioned passenger rail and freight. Transit in Greater Minnesota is another one. And then the aeronautics area is funded through the State Airport Fund. The second agency receiving budgetary appropriations is the Metropolitan Council. And so the Transportation Committee essentially covers a portion of the Metropolitan Council, the Transportation Division, through general fund appropriations. And the council also, as was touched on, receives motor vehicle sales tax revenue. Then the third area under the Transportation Committee's jurisdiction is part of the Department of Public Safety. So from a budgetary standpoint, the Department of Public Safety is shared between the Transportation and Public Safety Committees. And so some of the divisions are funded through the transportation budget, typically, and some of the divisions through the public safety budget. To some extent, that reflects historical circumstances when transportation and public safety were all one committee a number of years ago, and that's actually the case in the Senate budgetary world currently. So for transportation, State Patrol, Driver and Vehicle Services, there's an Office of Traffic Safety, an Office of Pipeline Safety, as well as some administrative services are all appropriations areas. The largest of those is the Trunk Highway Fund appropriation to the State Patrol, although there is a general fund appropriation as well that goes to the State Patrol for capital security. So that capital security function is not viewed as a trunk highway purpose. It's security around the Capitol complex, and so general fund is the funding source for that. There are also general fund dollars as part of the base in the transportation budget for some of the administrative commissioner's office, human resources, and so forth, those functions in the department. And then there are a couple of accounts in the special revenue fund, and that is the funding source for driver and vehicle services. I'll just touch briefly on driver and vehicle services. That's the division in the department that handles motor vehicle as well as driver licensing transactions. And they, along with the State Patrol, will probably make some number of appearances in the context of bills throughout the legislative session. Their financing structure is largely fee-based, so they don't typically receive general fund appropriations. Rather, there are a couple of accounts in the special revenue fund that provide the funding for the agency operations and functions. And that all comes out of fees that are associated with the transactions of driver licensing, motor vehicle titling, title transfers, vehicle registration. So the kind of basic licensing and registration functions include fees that are the core funding for driver and vehicle services. Looking at the budgetary jurisdiction from another standpoint, we can identify about $1.9 billion in the fiscal 16 base as in dollars that will come outside of the general fund. And then the general fund base also for fiscal 2016 is about $106 million. So this is just one way of kind of viewing the scope of general fund versus dedicated funds in the Transportation Committee's purview, absent further allocations. Finally, I'll touch on one history item in transportation finance, which is a change made in 2008. This has been referred to a couple of times over the course of the presentations and has come up in the past couple of legislative sessions just in general discussions around transportation finance. So I thought it might be useful for the committee to have some sense of the latest major transportation legislation in financing that occurred. This is often referred to as Chapter 152 after the law that it was enacted into in 2008. And there are a number of funding changes. The first of those was an increase in the motor fuels tax. that was phased in was just a per gallon rate increase. There was also a change in the registration tax, and that modification had a couple of components to it. There had been caps of the total amount that could be charged or taxed for a vehicle, and those caps were eliminated so that higher value vehicles would be taxed or would be owed a higher amount. There was also a couple of modifications to the depreciation schedule, so somewhat similar to what we had discussed earlier with aircraft depreciation. There's a schedule in the place that doesn't directly map to the depreciation and the value of a vehicle, but is a reflection of that depreciation concept, and that the rate of depreciation was modified. And there was also a hold harmless provision so that the tax couldn't increase for vehicles that had previously been registered in Minnesota. Motor vehicle lease sales tax had not gone towards transportation purposes until the 2008 legislation. So that was the time when it was initially partially allocated, with the $32 million staying in the general fund and the remainder going towards transportation. And as Mr. Lee commented on or discussed a little bit, we've seen a couple of changes in that allocation since the original split was set up. The County's Transit Improvement Board, the Joint Powers Board, was established through authorized really to impose a local option transportation sales tax in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. There was also authority for communities in greater Minnesota to establish transportation sales taxes as well. There was a large-scale trunk highway bonding set of authorizations, and that was actually split across a number of years. So it was a $1.8 billion, roughly, program that was authorized, but the appropriations were divided up across a number of years and then modified in future years. Originally, I believe it was set to go until fiscal 2018, was kind of accelerated a bit to complete in 2016. There was a new bridge improvement program for the Department of Transportation to implement, laid out in the 2008 legislation. And if you recall Monday's discussion of the county state aid formula, there are two pieces to that formula, kind of two components for how the revenue is allocated. And the so-called new revenue was set to be allocated under a new formula, and that's what was first put in place in 2008. So prior to the 08 legislation, there was just a single formula that had the components of, you know, part of it being equal, part of it based on highway needs, a couple other pieces with lane miles, if I'm remembering correctly. The flexible highway account, if you recall, there's the 5% set aside of funds coming out of the highway user tax distribution fund, and a portion of that set aside is allocated into this flexible highway account and then further distributed to counties and local units of government. And there were a couple of changes in that allocation also made in 2008. One of the notable aspects of that was that prior to 2008, a portion of the funds could go towards the trunk highway system, and that was shifted so that all of the funding would go to local units of government. That concludes our presentation today, and I'd be happy to take any further questions, Mr. Chair.
One quick question on the change there. We did allow for the greater Minnesota to enact the sales tax. How many counties have done that?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, we'll have to get back to you on the count for that. I don't believe it's been very many. I'm not aware of a large number of cases of it being imposed, but
okay,
we can check on that for you. There was some legislation enacted after 2008 that broadened the permissible purposes or permissible uses of the funds, and that might have accelerated since then. since the original provision was put into place.
Thank you. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Where does it talk about sidewalks and bikes? Where does that come from? Who gets to get the play on that? That's council only, and it is not mentioned, so we don't know about it. Who gives the money out? That's what I'm asking, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Earhart. If I could remind members to please use their microphones, we're reminded to make sure we're on record.
Mr. Chairman, I was asking who distributes the money and so forth for bike paths and sidewalks. Is that the Met Council, or where does that money come from?
Mr. Burris or Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair, we're just conferring for a moment. Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, there aren't specific appropriations in the budget for transportation going towards bike and pedestrian, with the main exception being the Safe Routes to Schools program. But there is funding for those uses somewhat baked into other allocations. Greater Minnesota Transit has some, I believe, has used some of the funding, the transit office. You know what? Rather than give you false information, Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, why don't we get back to you with details around the key funding sources for those purposes?
Mr. Chairman, sometimes when I listen to where that money seems to be coming from, I don't know if there's a requirement on some of the federal money that it be attached to sidewalks and bike paths, but I've been confused by it, watching my own city struggle with where they're going to paint bike lanes on streets in the city, some of which are too narrow for bikes and cars. But they put the lanes down anyway, so somebody must be giving them authorization on money, and I sure would like to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Earhart. We'll wait to hear from Mr. Burris and Mr. Lee. Mr. Burris?
And then, Mr. Chair, just two follow-up items. First, as I'm starting to think about the bike and pedestrian question, a lot of that is going to be local funding. So I'm initially drawing a bit of a blank because it's less of a state-funded set of activities. And then jumping back, Mr. Chair, to your question about the Greater Minnesota sales tax, getting assistance from the audience, it's currently 11 counties that have imposed that in Greater Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question comes back to the most recent motor fuels tax. You said it was phased in. Could you tell the committee when the last increase was, what year the last increase that phase in was allocated?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, fiscal year 2013 was the last piece of it.
Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. A couple questions regarding the airline pieces that you talked about. One, what percentage of the airline registration funds go exclusively to airports? Second question, same question roughly for the jet fuel tax. Do any of those dollars go to non-aviation related activities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, all of the funding goes either through grant programs administered by MnDOT or to MnDOT Aeronautics operations. So, if you would consider the aeronautics related activities of MnDOT's aeronautics office as you know, with it falling within that category, then it would be all of the state appropriations out of the state airports fund. And I'm sorry, if you could repeat the first question on the percentage I'll have to get back to you on
Mr. Chairman, just a simple question of, does any percentage or all percentage go back into aviation-related items? So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Sundin, do you have a question?
No.
All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We appreciate the overview, as usually did a fantastic job, and we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
At this time, members, we'll be moving to our presentation from representatives with the port, Minnesota Ports and Waterways. And at this time, I'd like those representatives to come up to the testifiers table. I think all three of you will be joining each other. Welcome to the committee, and please say your name for the committee and for the record, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. We have representatives here from the Red Wing Port Authority, the Duluth Port Authority, and also the St. Paul Port Authority. We each have some short comments that we'd like to share with the committee, and I'll start out. I am Randy Olson. I am the Executive Director of the Red Wing Port Authority, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the important role that our ports play in Minnesota's transportation system. As you are probably aware, there are several industries that rely on the state's port system to gain a competitive advantage in transporting goods internationally. In particular, our agricultural sector, corn and soybeans, for example, rely on the ports to move commodities out of the Great Lakes and down the Mississippi River. Construction activity also relies on the movement of cement and gravel and sand into the state. Our mining and our forest products industries move taconite and finished wood products out of the state also through our waterway system. The ports have always recognized that a multimodal transportation system is important, so we rely upon both rail and trucking as key partners in the movement of commodities to and through our ports. We need to maintain our port infrastructure in order to take advantage of opportunities for growth, particularly in emerging markets internationally, and we also must be concerned about the proper maintenance of our highways and our rail networks. So all three elements of our surface transportation infrastructure, be it roads, rail, and water, must work in concert. But it is noteworthy that moving bulk commodities by water can relieve traffic and reduce wear and tear on our roads and our rail systems. So the Minnesota Ports Association has worked with the organization MN 2050 to examine the need for greater investment in state infrastructure. MN 2050, in turn, has worked with Twin Cities Public Television to produce a series of documentaries regarding infrastructure needs. In fact, the latest, it's called State of Repair, Industries of Constant Motion, premiered just Monday this week, and it will be rebroadcast on Monday, January 18th. But the series highlights the need for increased funding for our state's infrastructure, which for the ports is accomplished through funding of the Port Development Assistance Program. Port development funds, and I believe funding began back in 1996, but they've been used for a host of projects, for example, to improve warehouse facilities, to rehabilitate road and rail access to port facilities, to dredge riverways, to provide access to ports, to repair dock walls, to establish new fleeting areas and cargo bulkheads and to purchase cargo handling equipment. All of these projects have contributed to more efficient operation of our ports and have improved and expanded the use of our waterways to move Minnesota commodities to market in a more cost-effective manner. I'd like to point out to an example with the City of Red Wing and how funds were effectively used through the Port Development Assistance Program. So Red Wing has an unloading terminal, but also an abandoned dock south of town. And through the Port Development Assistance Program, this abandoned dock was resurfaced and an access channel was dredged. And Red Wing has a major employer called USG. USG annually uses about 250,000 tons of slag. They convert this slag into a wool-like material that is in ship to a production facility in Cloquet, Minnesota, and that facility makes ceiling panels that are shipped around the world. Well, with this investment, it effectively eliminated 8,000 to 10,000 large dump trucks moving from the north side of town to the south side of town in Red Wing. It reduced congestion. It made the city safer. We also calculate that 10 miles have been taken off of each round trip for these 10,000 truckloads, saving time and fuel expense for the company. The city is less congested. It's safer. The business is more competitive. Jobs are more secure as a result of this modest investment to move the unloading terminal for the Red Wing Port Authority. This is the overall positive impact investments in our ports can produce for local communities and for the state as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Just a quick question I'll ask it of all of you. MnDOT came out with a statewide ports and waterways plan in September of 2014. Just curious how much input and what input were you asked for and what did you give for that report?
Mr. Chairman, Lori Lauder, Senior VP of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs, St. Paul Port Authority. Short answer, very much included. All of our ports were represented. I know I represented St. Paul there, and it was a very deep and, I guess you'd say, robust process, and I think that the end product is required reading, I think, for all of us.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also participated in a very extensive interviewing process. There was a consulting firm hired to effectively gather much of the data on the front end. And I have to say that the questions were very, very comprehensive.
Thank you very much. Who's next? Oh, I'm sorry. A couple of questions first. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, do you prefer questions after the panel, or should we just...
I think it's fine. We're on topics.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Olson, you had mentioned this sort of integrated approach around rail and highway and water transportation. Were you or maybe any of the other ports represented here impacted by this the problems we had over the summer and fall with the rail congestion and... goods not getting to market because of the variety of factors related to rail problems here in the state.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lori Lauder again, I think there was some slowdown. It was not a crisis. I think the worst part for us, speaking for St. Paul, was the flooding. And we've been working with FEMA to try to work on that.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned, Mr. Olson, you mentioned that a lot of ag product goes through the ports, and I'm just curious, a lot of that's produced in my district, and I'm wondering, do you know what percentage of the product annually goes through the ports?
Well, I can't, Mr. Chair and Representative, I cannot speak for the other ports, but the primary shipper of grain products in Red Wing is a company called Red Wing Grain. It's partially owned through a cooperative and also Cargill. and they service about a 40 to 50 mile radius, mostly small farmers that are producing corn and soybeans. And I would say that 95% of what they ship is corn and soybeans from the immediate area. But it's about the only thing they do.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a curiosity question here. Has any thought been given or has it been done to move oil by either river barge or lake tanker? Or is it being done, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, to my knowledge, oil is not being transported by barge, at least in Minnesota. It's primarily a commodity that's being transported through the rails.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
Given what has been going on with the pipelines and all this, that's another mode. Is nobody even considering it, or is it not feasible, or can you give any thoughts on that?
Any one of the testifiers have a comment? Ms. Lauder?
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of St. Paul, we were asked this question by the chamber a little bit ago, and I couldn't give you specific millions of gallons, but there is some oil transported in and out of the St. Paul Harbor, and I think it's minimal. I'd be happy to research that further and get you a percentage, so I think that's there.
Mr. Chairman, DeLuca. Representative, that's true of Duluth, the Duluth Port as well. There would be a big pushback. There has been pushback against the concept of shipping oil on the lakes. Just so you're aware that it would definitely be a process to achieve that as a
because of the environment.
Yes, environmental concerns. There are new double hulled ships. You know, there are new ships that are constructed specifically for that purpose. But they're not used yet on the lakes.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding this past summer when freight was held up on the rivers, and I'm not exactly sure why, but MnDOT wasn't able to get their concrete to do projects, so projects were held up. What I'm wondering is, can you tell me, refresh my memory, what caused that, and is that a phenomenon that's going to happen again? Or is there something to prevent it in the future?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm wondering if that isn't due mostly to the fluctuations in the river. We had some very, very high water levels in the late spring, early summer. And then we also had a period of actually this fall where levels were incredibly low because of lack of precipitation and runoff. So I'm speculating that it had to do with either flooding conditions or low water conditions.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, so is that something that is just the nature of using a river for transportation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that is the reality of shipping anything in a barge or container with water being your transportation resource, and that it is it's a volatile mode of transportation. And if not here, it can also be problematic downstream, for example, in the Mississippi or perhaps with the channels through the Great Lakes as well.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair and Representative, if I might add to Randy's comments, there's such a thing as, maybe you know, 100-year floods. And we've had a few anomalies here in the past 25 years or so where we've had three or four of those 100-year floods. And so Randy's right. In particular, this year was tough. And I know in the St. Paul Harbor, our main harbor operator just had to take through probably almost towards the end of August to do the cleanup from the spring flooding. So I guess it's a statistical question as to whether we'll still experience a lot of that, but it has been an anomaly.
Well, statistically, then, we shouldn't see one for 300 or 400 years,
yeah.
Right?
I guess that's how the math works, Mr. Chair.
Right. Okay. Next testifier, is there Ms. DeLuca or Ms. Lauder?
Can you hear me from this? Do you want me to push Laurie down?
Yeah.
Probably just need to lean in a little bit more. Thank you.
I'll love the opportunity to push Laurie Lauder around. All right. I'm Deborah DeLuca. I'm the Director of Government and Environmental Affairs for the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and representatives. Thank you very much for this opportunity to tell the story of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. We're kind of, you know, far removed from St. Paul and love any chance for visibility. I provided you with a packet of information about the port, and I'll reference some of this information as we're going as I give my testimony. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority is a state economic development agency. Our mission is to generate domestic and international trade, advance regional industrial development, and advocate for the maritime industry. We are the only seaway port authority in the state, and we own and manage multiple industrial properties and transportation infrastructure on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Perhaps most notably, the Kluwer Public Marine Terminal. There's a map of that facility in your packet if you're interested. This is the only general cargo facility and the only public terminal in Minnesota. That's where small and mid-sized businesses can access international shipping channels to export their goods. We also represent the interests of 20 private bulk terminals in the Port of Duluth. The Port of Duluth is actually the largest port on the Great Lakes, and it may be a little surprising, we're also the 19th largest port in the United States by tonnage. Each year, some 38 million short tons of cargo move through the port by water. We are served by four Class 1 railroads, and that's unique. Most ports are served by one or two. We're definitely an intermodal port. Millions of additional tons of cargo move through the port solely by rail and road and never touch a ship. So those modes of transportation are important to us. The cargo has to get to us in order to ship it out. We are Minnesota's only deep water international port. We are our state's only direct connection via water to countries in Europe, the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and North Africa. It's only a 2-week trip from Duluth from the Kluwer Public Terminal to Europe. What does this mean in Minnesota? The Port of Duluth gives worldwide exposure to Minnesota's manufacturing, mining, agricultural, and energy sectors. We're important to the southern and western Minnesota farming communities as well as to the mining communities of the north. The Great Lakes St. Lawrence Seaway provides a high-capacity, low-cost, very energy-efficient mode for transporting bulk commodities like iron ore, coal, limestone, salt, cement, and grain, as well as heavy lift and project cargoes for the mining, oil and gas production, construction, wind energy, pulp and paper, and power generation industries. Shipping is a very efficient means to move cargoes long distances. The carbon footprint is much lower for shipping than it is for land transit. At a time when land transit is struggling to keep up with demand, it's important to recognize that shipping iron ore to steel manufacturing centers in Ohio and Pennsylvania and Indiana and agricultural commodities to Europe provides a partial solution to those transit congestion problems we were just discussing, and it also lessens the wear and tear on our highways. For over a century, the port has been one of the largest drivers of economic activity in northern Minnesota. Today, the port activities help support over 11,500 jobs and generate $1.5 billion in business revenues to bolster the state's economy. Businesses operating in our industrial development, our own industrial properties, directly employ more than 1,100 people and pay them living wage jobs. Well, how do we operate? We have only a very modest property tax levy from the city of Duluth. That's 0.01813%. It's very small. It amounts to less than $1 million per year. And we receive grant funds. But the majority of our operational budget is self-generated from our cargo handling and property leasing activities. At the same time, we have millions upon millions of dollars worth of public infrastructure to maintain. For instance, it costs $3,000 per lineal foot to maintain or to build a dock wall, and we maintain nearly 9,000 feet of dock wall. We also maintain over 700,000 square feet of building space. Half of that is leased to private employers, and the other half is available for cargo handling and warehousing, and that's a fee-based service. Really, at the Chlor terminal, we maintain and manage a micro-city, inclusive of roads, rail, utilities. That Chlor public terminal was built over 50 years ago. So much of the infrastructure, including that 9,000 feet of dock walls, has a life expectancy of 50 years. Actually, our office is part of that 50-year-old infrastructure, and it's kind of like walking into a Mad Men, a set from a Mad Men. You have to come see it. We manage these assets in a way that produces a solid and consistent return for the taxpayer in Minnesota. We generate roughly $2 million in annual lease revenues and approximately $1.5 million in annual revenues from our cargo handling facilities, yet the infrastructure costs are immense. To supplement this revenue, we pursue federal grants. We've received $20 million in federal grants, primarily infrastructure-related, in the past 15 years, and we're amping up that activity. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority may be a public sector state agency, but we really operate and hold ourselves to the standards of a private sector nonprofit organization, meaning we leverage state dollars to bring in dollars from out of state, and then we reinvest that in public infrastructure. So what do we need from you? As we are paying for and maintaining the road, rail, and dock infrastructure of the port's only international deep sea port, well, I didn't mention one piece of our financing yet, and that's the State Port Development Assistance Program administered by Minnesota Department of Transportation. These funds are critical to rounding out our infrastructure investments and providing the required match for large federal grants that we need to actually implement the infrastructure projects. And this program really is the final piece in our funding puzzle. For example, right now, Randy gave a great example for Redring. Right now in Duluth, we're rehabilitating a dock. It's Dock C and D. It's been underutilized or vacant for over 20 years. It's adjacent to our Chlor terminal. And because it's been vacant for 20 years or underutilized, it's generated little to no tax revenue and no job opportunities. It lacked rail and road connections. The private sector abandoned it long ago for this reason. The dock wall was crumbled and dilapidated. The channel slip, which is adjacent to the dock wall, needed dredging so that it could accommodate fully laden ships. Actually, it's still in that state because we haven't started the project yet. But so the first phase of redevelopment of this dock is a $16 million project. And at the end of that $16 million project, it will be a fully functioning dock. And that will put the dock back into productive use. It will link it to road and rail. It will accommodate heavy lift cargo and expand the types of cargoes we can carry. It also expands the capacity of the Chlor terminal, creating new jobs and additional opportunities to move Minnesota cargoes on the Great Lakes. It might be interesting. Lori will like this and appreciate this. The first step of this is an environmental cleanup because it's also a brownfield site. But this project will be shovel-ready, be a shovel-ready redevelopment site where private businesses can invest in Minnesota and create jobs, but that's in the second phase of development. For this very important project, we used Port Development Assistance Grant funds. We used $2.33 million, and that money leveraged a $10 million U.S. Department of Transportation grant and approximately $3.75 million of our own port funds. The Minnesota Port Development Assistance Program was funded with only about $2 million last year, and those are funds that we shared amongst five ports. Of course, my colleagues here, and then also Winona and Minneapolis. So we request that you support continued, consistent, and hopefully increased funding of the Port Development Assistance Grant Program. I do want to note that we're not asking for a donation. We're asking for an investment in the state's port infrastructure. I think I've demonstrated we can promise to you at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority that we'll use this money to leverage private and public funds, economic activity and jobs, and produce a solid return for the taxpayers in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. In addition to the packet, I provided you with one of our coveted wall calendars. I think Mr. Kevin Wally is going to distribute them in the next couple of days. And they're valued at less than $5 each. I didn't put them in the mailing tubes just to ensure that. anyway, this is the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. It really is your state's port. Please come up and take a tour anytime. I put my card in the packet. It's fun to visit. It's a fascinating and kind of unique place.
Thank you, Mr. Luca. A couple questions here. One quick question. What would be an average annual budget that you're operating on? Do you have an annual?
You know what? I'm actually, I should have that right at the top of my head, and I don't. And can I get that to you?
That's fine.
Get it to you later today, even.
That's fine. Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Luca, for your presentation. It's wonderful to know the activity we have. We've been hearing about water levels on the rivers and the impacts of that, too, and I'm aware of water level variances in Lake Superior as well. Has that had any impact in the port and its ability to manage the shipments?
Actually, right now, the water levels are at a high. In fact, for the first time, we got a call from a private landowner up into the estuary complaining about the high water levels and wondering whether we couldn't do something about them. But low water levels don't really affect the port so much. They can affect the locks up further up in on the seaway.
Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Luca. Yeah, just to follow up on those water levels, wasn't it just a few years ago the ships had to run light to get through, and now the water levels are up?
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. and Representative, you're absolutely right. That when the water levels do run low, I should have been more thorough in my answer, that the ships can't be, it depends on the depth, can sometimes not be laden as heavily, and that's, again, why it's really important to maintain the navigational channel dredging.
Right. Follow-up?
Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My real main question is, with the renaissance of mining on the range, the Acer project and possibly Polymet and things like that, how is that going to affect your volume? Are you going to see more jobs? Are you going to see more volume, particularly with taconite and iron ore coming through the port?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. And the broader question is, all of our traffic through the port is so dependent on markets that we are often surprised. But yes, if all the mining projects come to fruition as planned, we do expect an increased ore volume through the port, and we would expect increased jobs. I don't have those numbers. I don't have projection numbers for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the great presentation. I get the sense that most of the products that we move through our ports are bulk and that type of thing. Is there any container handling capabilities we have in any of our ports?
I'll take this first and then hand it on to the river folks.
Mr. Luca.
That's a great question. So all the private terminals are bulk terminals, and our terminal is what we call break bulk. It's all stuff that can be lifted with a crane, super sacks of grain, specialty items. We're actually just starting a new service with a shipping company out of Antwerp that they are using this very unique ship that has flexible tween deck structure, so it can take on different sizes of loads and take multiple loads from multiple clients. And so what that means is that, sorry, I don't know if this is getting back to answer your question, that will be seeing increased container, small container, not the standard huge containers you see in Seattle and Long Beach and such, but smaller containers and sort of unique sizes on stuff for the smaller and mid-sized business that wants to ship their stuff overseas. But in general, we do not see ourselves becoming a container port, but a large container port.
Representative Brunbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in general, of all of you, are we missing a big segment of potential business? I mean, could we, you know, expand our, you know, our economy out of the ports if we had, you know, Class A, world-class facilities?
Mr. Chair, I'll start out, if I might, and Representative Brunbeck. A little different answer to that, just in terms of, as Deb mentioned, the market. The market in the Twin Cities now is that, as you know, Minneapolis is closing their port. So when we think of what that will do to the St. Paul Harbor, that's an opportunity for us to take on more business from some of those businesses that are currently located in the harbor. And, of course, that's a challenge and an opportunity in terms of added infrastructure that we would need, additional funding for that infrastructure. But that's one market question. The other market question or answer is the global situation is that, as you probably know, the global markets have really been expanded to customers. I'll just speak for St. Paul for a minute. Westway Trading and some of the other 29-plus businesses in the harbor do a lot of global work. And that's being expanded by the Panama Canal's expansion. As you may have heard, the Panama Canal, and I believe they should be wrapping up a 4 or 5 year construction process this year, which is making the Panama Canal deeper and wider. And those Panamax vessels are now able to serve our shippers who go down to the Gulf of Mexico, and now they can offload onto the Panamax vehicles or ships, which then provides a tremendous opportunity for additional global work, global exporting to the Asian markets. And prior to that being available, they've been forced to just take a left, so to speak, out of the Gulf of Mexico and go to the African and European markets. So that's another opportunity that I think is just around the corner.
Mr. Olson?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative Runback, before the holiday season, we convened a meeting with a number of employers that are largely manufacturing big containers, big metal containers that are used in oil refining and agriculture. And what we were told is that increasingly it's challenging to ship those large containers out of Minnesota ports. And in some cases, they're being trucked to Oklahoma or Texas. In some cases, the cost of transportation actually exceeds the cost of the manufactured product. And it's we need to do some homework to really assess how big a problem this is, how sustainable the problem is, and whether, for example, there's a role for our Port Authority to actually become a solution for heavy hauling. But it also involves, you know, all kinds of issues with road infrastructure, bridge ability, the weight kinds of restrictions on bridges. So, it's not a simple solution that I think a single port can address, but it is something that is on our radar screen.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a serious question to ask that doesn't have to do with what we've been talking about right now, but it does have to do with what your role is at the Port Authority, at the financing, as well as policy work that can be done or has been done around human trafficking. Could you share? My daughter went to school in Duluth, and the women students were given very stern warning about sex trafficking and human trafficking at the port. Wanted to know how that relates to financing of it and policies and the work that you do.
You know, we are. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have a staff person who spends a lot of time on this issue and working with the university and the police force and just on this issue and research that's being done. We don't, in terms of financing and such, we've asked the city if we couldn't essentially stake out some of these to get actual data on what's happening now. A lot of the stories that we get are older. There's no doubt that it's like, I mean, I don't have data on the degree to which it's happening now, but no one does. And that's one of our issues. But we are very active in the issue in Duluth and take place in all the task forces and such.
Okay. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Runbeck's question because the Winona Port is not represented here today. I used their story for a number of years as they told it in their local newspaper that as a result of, in this case, I think it was some of the geobonding that we had done for the ports and what they had managed to do, that they doubled the tonnage through their port.
And if you imagine doubling the tonnage through the port, presumably that also has a huge impact on land, on a number of the surrounding businesses. So, I mean, clearly it's measurable, and I'm certain you've done that with an improvement. It has a measurable impact on the business you're able to accommodate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I didn't get a chance to give Duluth's answer. The Great Lakes are at 50% capacity. There's a lot of opportunity to expand there and to increase our shipping, and we wouldn't be taking on the Dock C&D project if we didn't think there was. So there is a big opportunity for expansion. The accompanying infrastructure is very important. Getting heavy lift cargo in and out of the port and up those hills out of Duluth, there's many connected infrastructure issues.
Speaking of those projects, Mr. Luke, what would, once they're ready, what capacity would they be at? Would you project they'd be at, and how long before they would be to 70-80% of capacity?
I'm sorry, Mr. Kelly, I missed the last part of the question.
Just what would your progression be on the capacity use of that once those were brought up to speed?
Mr. Kelly, the Dock C&D?
Yes.
Well, for instance, one way to look at it is acreage. The Clure Public Terminal is 120 acres. Dock C&D is another 28 acres. So I don't have a percentage. I could do the head math if I hadn't just been driving down in traffic. But let me get you the exact prediction for the expanded capacity. I don't have it in my head right now.
Okay, thanks. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about, we attribute many of our aquatic invasive species to your ocean-going ships coming into the Great Lakes and into your harbor that we are being invaded with in Minnesota here. And so I'm wondering what is going on with the future control of such species so that we don't get worse off than we are now.
Okay. Mr. Luca.
Representative Kelly, Mr. Chair and Representative. We're doing a lot. Invasive species is a big deal on the Great Lakes. An interesting fact, though, since the practice of shocking the exchange water, salt with salt water, before the ocean-going ships come into the St. Lawrence Seaway, that started in 2006, there hasn't been a new invasive species identified in the Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence Seaway system since that time that was brought in from the ocean from that path. That maybe this Asian carp, but those have come from elsewhere. So that's one thing to note, but that doesn't mean we're still not working on it. We're partners with a program called the Great Ships Initiative. It's a program of the Northeast Midwest Institute. Remember them? They're very involved in Great Lakes issues, and they operate. It's the only freshwater testing facility for treatment, ballast water treatment and testing technologies, and it's right over in the Superior Harbor, the Superior portion of the harbor. And so we are in conjunction with them seeking to identify reliable technologies to treat and exchange ballast water.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then I assume that when you're saying the St. Lawrence Seaway, that's where they dump their ballast and pick up fresh?
Oh, that's a really complicated question, Mr. Chair and Representative. It's a complicated question. Before they enter the seaway, they need to do a saltwater exchange, and then it depends on this. It's very complicated by all the state boundaries they have to cross, and boundary into Canada, because each state has different requirements. So there's several ballast exchange. There can be several ballast exchanges required, depending on how far their path through the lakes is.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Driskowski, one last question before we get to Ms. Lauder to hear about St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Panel, as we look at the increase of the production of the Bakken area and the oil that has consumed the capacity of our trains, which traditionally have been used to to haul our grains to market to a great extent. I'm assuming it's placing more more market pressure on your facilities. Could you, and I know, Mr. Olson, you may have done some of that earlier, but can you kind of characterize that and what has happened? And then on the alternative, what will happen in the return if we actually get some pipelines built from there and take some of that oil off the trains? I think a lot of us in agricultural regions are hoping we can get above $3 corn at some point, so hopefully some of that will happen. But what will happen to your facilities if and when that does happen?
Exactly. Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative. Exactly. Can you tell that I'm new at my job? It's been since July. The Bakken project, or the pipeline, Sandpiper pipeline for us, well, first of all, the congestion on the rails affects us. It affects us greatly because that's how the cargo, that's how the grain gets to the port to ship out. So if it can't get to us, then that's a problem. And in fact, Canada, a lot of more grain went through Thunder Bay this year because they were able to impose requirements on the railroads there as to how much grain they could carry than came through Duluth. So I actually don't have the final numbers for the year, but I believe for a while we were seeing a drop off in grain this year compared to the year before. So it's an issue. The pipeline should be a help. I mean, it should free up cargo space on the train. I don't know. No one knows exactly to what extent.
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I could add from a Red Wing perspective, we have just a huge frequency of trains that go through the area on a daily basis, and much of that is, in fact, due to the increasing number of oil cars from the Bakken. I think that if there was a thoughtful discussion about alternatives, be it pipeline alternatives or perhaps more capacity for ports to ship oil, I think that would be a good thing, because I think, you know, as we all know, the concentration of oil car activity is preventing other commodities from being shipped in the rails, and it's a very imperfect system right now. So I think, again, if there could be a more thoughtful discussion about how there could be less reliance on train shipments and other alternatives, I think that would be very beneficial.
Representative Horstein,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick. We spent quite a bit of time on this issue last year, and I hope we will again here this year. And there's going to be reports coming out from MnDOT and the Department of Public Safety. But, you know, people assume that just the pipelines are the alternative, and we definitely need to be doing something about the rails. But Mr. Christensen from MnDOT did testify at a hearing that we had in fall that, you know, it's a minimal impact, that building all these pipelines will have minimal impact on the rail congestion. So, you know, it's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison, at least according to MnDOT, and I imagine they'll be testifying at some point about that. So I just wanted to be cautious, because it seems to be coming up more and more now that if we build all these pipelines, where somehow the trains will magically disappear, and that's not what we're hearing from MnDOT, that there's going to be rail problems into the future. So just wanted to make that point.
Thank you, Representative Horstein, and we will be hearing more about that and discussing that, I'm sure. Ms. Lauder, I would like to move on to your role at the St. Paul. And we are running down close to committee time. There is one thing that with the closing of the locks, I guess I'm very curious to hear how that's going to affect both business and I think Mr. Olson actually had a pretty good segue into that when he was talking about the reduction of approximately 8,000 trucks on the road because of the additions there. And now we're looking at an increase in possible trucks on the road between St. Paul and Minneapolis. So I'm just curious as to what we think is going to go on there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And great question, because what we see is that obviously from a geographic standpoint, upon the closure of the Minneapolis harbor, then the St. Paul harbor becomes the northernmost inland waterway port. We do have room to grow. We have a severe aging infrastructure issue. Most of our dock walls, which are kind of like the highways of a port, if we can look at that analogy, most of our dock walls were constructed during the WPA days of the 1930s. And then there was another group of dock walls that were built during the 60s. And when you do the math, it's still, they are well beyond their 50-year asset life. So with additional business opportunities for businesses to perhaps come to the St. Paul Harbor, then two things. One is that we do have some additional space to construct a couple more new dock walls. And I should add, thanks to this program, about 5 years ago, we did construct a 1,200 lineal foot new dock wall in our Southport area, and we're very grateful for that. We are now seeing more companies. There's a Stuartville company that is going to be building 68,000 square feet of a new facility right along that new dock wall. So there is more space to build new dock walls in the harbor as the market demand would increase, presumably from Minneapolis. And B, we really need to continue to pay attention to our aging dock walls. I presented a couple of years ago a large photograph, Mr. Chair, of a dock wall failure. And I should mention, you have one map from me, which is of the St. Paul Harbor. So when I name terminals, maybe that will pop out to you. The dock wall failure was on a part of barge terminal number one, which by land you access that, one accesses that by Childs Road. And that dock wall failure was just on the inside, the land side of the sheetrock dock wall. And it was large enough that a gentleman who worked at Morton Salt, I believe it was, fell in. And he was able to put his arms out just in time so that he didn't fall way, way down. Also, a truck went by, I think it was during the evening, sort of like a pickup truck, and fell in as well. And so there are these kinds of things that happen as a result of dock wall failures. That's one of the oldest dock walls. And I also should mention, just for the record, Mr. Chair, you see a lot of URS names here, and that's important. We lease to a company. We lease land and we lease those yellow hashes, which are the fleeting areas, to a company by the name of Upper River Services. So if you're here and you're looking at our harbor or anywhere on the river where you see the towboats and the barges, that rolling stock, so to speak, is owned by Upper River Services. So we have a long-term lease with them. So, Mr. Chair, bottom line on your question is there is opportunity, and we really seriously have an aging infrastructure issue, which I think is probably definitely the case with the other ports, including Winona.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and testifier as well. It was short, so I was a little bit unprepared. The question I was asked was, with the change and the closing of that lock, there will be a certain amount of volume that will be switched over to the St. Paul lock and in that particular port. Do you have an idea of how much that would be and where the destination of a lot of that product is either coming from or going to?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't have numbers at this time because we have not spoken nor have we been approached directly by some of those companies or any of those companies. We have been in touch with the Economic Development Agency in Minneapolis from time to time. And I think the range, I would want to research this more for you, but the range is quite broad in terms of some of the steel operations, the steel recycling operations, which I believe are at a minimum statewide, possibly regional. And that would be a question land use-wise, whether those type companies could go to St. Paul, all the way to many other companies in the manufacturing arena and so forth, and I would have to look to see what their range is, but I suspect it's beyond the metro in most cases. Be happy to get further information for you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I think that gets really to the point. The question I would be asking is where then the infrastructure needs for transporting from the St. Paul port to wherever those locations are would probably be extended, and would be curious to know, you know, what we'd be talking about in additional traffic, tonnage, et cetera, that's moving through. Thank you.
Great point. Mr. Chair, thank you, and I have a prepared statement, but I know you're short for time, so your pleasure on that.
Actually, Ms. Lauder, I was running on last year's time. That's 2:30 is our actual time, so feel free to interject.
So I should go?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to be quick. We've covered a lot of points that I was going to make, but I appreciate it. Thank you. As I said, I'm Lori Lauder with the St. Paul Port Authority, and thank you for your time. I've mentioned our critical aging infrastructure issue, and every year it just continues to get worse. And wanted to mention the efficiency factor, the efficiency of transshipment of cargo through our ports benefits many sectors of the state economy, as you can imagine. And the Ports Development Assistance Program, which I believe is about 21 years old now, has been critically important to maintain our port infrastructure. You've heard from Red Wing and you've heard from Duluth, so I won't repeat some of what they've said. But I did want to, on behalf of the Winona Port Authority, mention that they have recently, over the past several years, removed a sunken barge which was disrupting the movement of traffic to and from their commercial dock. They've replaced barge mooring facilities, and they've constructed a new mooring cell and rehabilitated their existing commercial dock wall. Winona also received port development funds for a dredging project which became part of a multimodal transportation improvement project for their community. Here in St. Paul, in our harbor, we have rehabilitated warehouse roofs, repaired several areas of dock walls, as I've mentioned, dredged a barge fleeting area, upgraded a mooring site, and improved road access to our port facilities. In this harbor here in St. Paul, by the way, we have a little over 30 businesses, which represent over 750 private sector jobs. And, of course, Mr. Chair, very little of this work could have been accomplished without state financial participation through this Ports Development Assistance Program. Looking forward into this 2015 session, each of our four public ports have important projects to complete. As far as Winona, they're seeking support for heavy dock lift capabilities. Red Wing is looking to establish a new commercial transient dock. Duluth wants to finish C&D dock, as Deb mentioned. And our priority, of course, is on dock wall reconstruction and maintenance and taking on business from Minneapolis, if that's what will happen, and hopefully construct another dock wall or two. With your continued support, Mr. Chair, we'll address our backlog of infrastructure projects. We keep a running tab on that, and the list keeps getting longer and longer. As I said, we do appreciate the funding we have received, and we really need to work that list. I will close with a statement that the former Duluth Port Authority CEO said a few years ago. His name is Davis Helberg, and he said, "Waterborne commerce uses less energy, causes less environmental degradation, generates less waste disposal, is responsible for fewer accidents, and creates the least societal disruption, and is almost always cheaper." So there are some calculations. For example, Mr. Chair, one barge equals 70 semi-trucks. And so there are a lot of different environmental business operations kind of comparisons, which I'd be happy to provide you at your pleasure sometime in the future. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder, Mr. Luca, and Mr. Olson. We appreciate your time, and thank you for being at the committee. Just as a sidebar for the committee, we were discussing that the closure of the locks, and preliminary data suggests, and by the way, that's unprecedented. That's never been done before federally. That federal legislation actually closed the locks. But as Ms. Lauder said, 70 trucks per barge unit. And so the effect of that is that approximately 20,000 truckloads of aggregate will need to be shipped from St. Paul to Minneapolis because of that. So that to me is a major transportation issue that that both cities will have to encounter. Representative McMurray, did you have a statement or a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, basically there's two products that historically had moved through the St. Anthony upper and lower locks recently. It was aggregate moving up from Great Cloud Island, as you mentioned, which is just below St. Paul, and it would go through the Ford Dam lock and through the upper and lower St. Anthony Falls dock to get to the Minneapolis port. After July 30th, June 30th, based on federal legislation, as you alluded to, that no longer is an option. We are looking at the different options that are available to potentially offload below the St. Anthony lock, the gravel, to minimize the need to truck that material as it goes to the only concrete plant in downtown Minneapolis. So hopefully we can find some way to do the aggregate. The shredder, the recycling facility above the lock and dam in Minneapolis, we'll have to truck the material from there to the St. Paul port. And that is, if I'm not mistaken, I believe it's 80 barges a year, so you can do the math on that. The aggregate is 2 barges every day normally, and when times are really good, it can be 4 barges a day going up the river. So unfortunately, there's going to be significant stress on our highways going forward unless we find some solutions rather quickly.
Thank you, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know who's got the answer. Collectively, you always ask for a specific bonding amount among all of you. Do you have that number?
Ms. Lauder?
Mr. Chair, on behalf of the Ports Association, we are requesting $10 million.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi, did you have?
Yes, thank you, Chair Kelly. I just wanted to comment as well. It would be an impact on Minneapolis and St. Paul as well as MnDOT, because they're the ones who are responsible probably for the major roadways that would be traveling. Could you?
Absolutely. Any further clarification or? Okay, thank you very much. We'd just like to remind members, if you want any documents saved, just put those in your save file, and staff will make sure that's done. Another reminder, we will not be meeting on next Monday, Martin Luther King Day. Next Wednesday, the 21st, we will have the MnDOT Rail Crossing Safety Study, and we will discuss rail safety. All right. And this meeting is adjourned.